A little over a week ago, the General Assembly meeting in Portland approved an overture that originated with the session at Southminster, but was conceived and written by the Presbyterian Peace Fellowship, and you can find their website online to find out more about them. Former moderator of the General Assembly, Rick Ufford Chase, had the idea, and our friend Eric Clark, who preached my installation, wrote it with Rick and some others. And our session kind of laundered it through. So we voted that it be sent to the Presbytery of Cascades, and then from the Cascades it went on to the General Assembly and finished meeting last week. But our own June Carlson was the overture advocate, and she spoke for it at the General Assembly and organized all the advocates, and it was approved by the committee unanimously, and then by the Assembly by a voice vote, as it was just put on the consent agenda. Don't let the unanimous acclamation fool you. This overture was not an obvious pass or formality, like thanking a missionary for a lifetime of service or rubber stamping some bureaucratic matter. This is a statement that calls the church out in very specific ways. And so I'm going to read the text that was approved. And then my sermon will be the rationale. So this was the text that was approved. 7 points. 1. The Presbyterian Church USA will do the following. Recommit ourselves at the congregational level, the mid-council level, and the national level of our church to locate ourselves with the poor, to advocate with all of our voice for the poor, and to seek opportunities to take risks for and with the poor. In soup kitchens, in Catholic worker houses, among the immigrants, with those working to end mass incarceration, and with those who seek to protect all of us, especially the poorest of the poor, around the world from the vagaries of climate change. Okay, that's number one on our to-do list. 2, call on our churches to commit to a year of Bible study focused on issues of social justice, with particular attention to the matters of race proposed in item 1108, and that was actually Truth and Reconciliation Report for Native Americans and African Americans, and the application of the Confession of Belhar, that was passed from South Africa, to these concerns. That's 2. Number 3, call on our presbyteries and synods to examine their own practice, placing these commitments at the center of their concerns, and to streamline the way that the assembly, by adopting procedures so that overtures and proposals on peacemaking and social justice concerns from sessions and committees may be considered quickly by the General Assembly. 4, facilitate the processes by which these concerns can be brought before us as a national body, by resisting new barriers to overture submissions, such as additional concurrences, tighter deadlines, or overture topic restrictions at the General Assembly. I'll explain that one a little bit. There were overtures from other presbyteries that wanted to make it harder to send social justice measures up, and the Assembly rejected them completely and answered all of those, actually, with this overture. 5, commit to focusing a significant block of the time allotted for future General Assemblies on creating opportunities in consultation with the Committee on Local Arrangements to engage all of the commissioners, delegates, and observers in acts of service to and with communities at risk. So in other words, don't just come to the General Assembly and meet and then eat at a fancy restaurant, but go out and do some good stuff in the local community. 6, assure that there are voices of those who are most at risk from within our church and outside of it, including interfaith voices, who are invited to share with and challenge the assembly, both in the plenary and committee sessions. One of the challenges that came before this past assembly was Imam Saeed, here of the Muslim education area, and he gave a prayer before the General Assembly. The right wing of the church and all the Christian right media has just trounced it and trounced the Presbyterian Church for allowing him, to a Muslim, to pray in church, pray at the Presbyterian General Assembly, which is obviously just nuts. But other than that, what he said in there in his prayer was so important. It was, he said, he prayed for, can you imagine him, first of all, praying in a church, what it might feel like, and then he prayed, that we all might overcome Islamophobia and our bigotry. He was right. He's right to call us out on that. Because in response to his prayer, you read the layman. I don't know if you ever heard of that organization. All the comments there were just filled with that kind of stuff in reaction to his prayer. Our Muslim friends are looking for, did I tell you this? When I was at the Ramadan Tent Project, and one of the parents, he's one of the founders of the Islamic Center across the street, and he said to me, you know, he sent the speech I gave to his friends in Iran because they can't believe that a church would do this. In other words, the Muslim community as a whole thinks the church, all the church, and you can imagine, it's all one voice. I mean, you hear the radio, what do you hear? It doesn't like them, is out to get them. They are alone in many respects. And that's why it's so important, and I'm so proud of you for connecting and being a different voice. I didn't mean to actually preach on this. I just meant to read it. All right. Final point, number 7. Recommend that the Presbyterian Mission Agency, through its Compassion, Peace, and Justice Ministries area, implement a coordinated strategy or cycle of social engagement that will assure that concerns around confronting racism, environmental concerns, standing against violence and militarism, and advocating for the dispossessed come before the assembly on a regular and consistent basis, consulting on mission strategies and overtures with affected and engaged presbyteries before each general assembly on topics of the most immediate concern. And the reason for this overture is to remind the church that its charter is one of engagement on social justice issues. We're not called to hide from this charter because social justice issues might be considered divisive or might upset some people or might make us uncomfortable because of our own complicity in unjust and unsustainable structures. Now, there is a difference of opinion in the church, which comes as no surprise. And to put it far too simply, nonetheless clearly, is the purpose of the church to affirm, recite, and try to evangelize people into believing correct doctrines about Jesus? Or is the purpose of the church to show up where Jesus showed up? Rick Ufford Chase has written an exciting book that would be a great study book for us. It's called Faithful Resistance: Gospel Visions for the Church in a Time of Empire. And he talked with me about it on the radio program, which will be broadcast soon. And it's a book of essays from a number of thinkers, people, Presbyterian folks and others. And then each has a chapter, then he responds to each one. And I'll give you a sense of the scope. Here are the titles. Confronting Empire at the Border, talking about the sanctuary movement. Dismantling White Supremacy, Reimagining Ecological Theology, Learning Nonviolence in a Multi-Faith World, Resisting the Seduction of Silence. That's a great title. The Local Congregation as the Locus of Resistance, Theological Education as an Act of Subversion, Mission as a Move to the Margins, Institutional Church as an Expression of Solidarity, and Dismantling the Corporate Church as a Step Toward Liberation. I just want to give you who wrote that last chapter. The last chapter of Dismantling the Corporate Church was written by the highest corporate guy in the church, J. Herbert Nelson, who was elected stated clerk, first African-American to do so. He worked for the Washington office. So we're seeing, I think, an exciting opportunity in the larger body. Now, Rick Ufford Chase is an engaging and a passionate speaker. He said to me in our interview that many people of all ages have left the church, not only young people, but people of 50s, 60s, 70s, and older, because it's irrelevant. They perceive it as too concerned with doctrines and beliefs and not caring about what really goes on in the world. He said what's important is where the church is willing to show up. And that's the phrase he used, willing to show up. Is the church willing to show up with the houseless? Is the church willing to show up on the border? Is the church willing to show up for our Muslim neighbors? Is the church willing to show up for the incarcerated? So I thought, in the spirit of this overture, that I would devote my series of sermons this summer on issues of social justice, where the church is asked to show up. And after each sermon, we're going to have a little church chat. Beginning today, give you an opportunity to engage further conversation with me and others. As you know, and I will say it again and again, all I do is poke. I don't tell you what to do or what to think. I just want to stir it up so we can together come back and see where the Spirit is leading us. So the sermons are going to be based on texts actually from our scriptural tradition. It's interesting that when people find themselves engaging in issues of justice, they often see their ancient texts, their own scriptural texts, with new eyes. And that's the case whether these texts be the Torah or the Gospel or the Quran. They tell us, really, because they're ultimately about movements that began in oppression and injustice. Moses, Jesus, Muhammad, all three cases easily. So it shouldn't be surprising, although it often is for me, that when we brush away all the cobwebs of centuries of imperial interpretation, we find that these scriptures contain radical calls for showing up. Radical calls for resistance as well as empowerment. So, the overture approved by the General Assembly is called On Choosing to Be a Church Committed to the Gospel of Matthew 25. So I thought it might be fun to talk about Matthew 25 today. What is Matthew 25? And it contains three parables that Alita read for us. Parables of Jesus as framed by the author of the Gospel of Matthew. The parable of the wise and foolish bridesmaids, the parable of the talents, and the parable of the last judgment. And this chapter concludes Matthew's teaching about Jesus. This is Jesus' final speech. Chapter 26 leads into the plot to kill him and the story of his betrayal and ultimate crucifixion. So this is his final lecture, his last sermon. It's the summit, the climax, the stuff he wants to get across. And when I say he, I mean Matthew's Jesus. All right. So what is the movement of these three parables? Well, first of all, we have the bridesmaids and their lamps. And from this story, we get that wonderful choral piece that we sang as a hymn, Keep Your Lamps Trimmed and Burning. So five are wise, five are foolish. The foolish don't bring extra oil. And when they go to get it, they miss the party. So there's an urgency to showing up. We can't just say, yeah, I'll show up. Maybe next week. There is an urgency to show up when called. We have to be ready when the moment comes. The late Henry Nouwen told this story in his book, The Wounded Healer. He says, a rabbi came across the prophet Elijah and said to him, hey, when's the Messiah coming? And Elijah said, well, go ask him yourself. Well, where is he? Said the rabbi. He's sitting at the gates of the city, said Elijah. Well, how will I know which one is the Messiah? And Elijah said, he's sitting among the poor covered with wounds. The others unbind all their wounds at once and then bind them all up again. But he unbinds one at a time and then binds it up again, saying to himself, perhaps I shall be needed. If so, I must always be ready so as not to delay for a moment. So there's one way to keep our lamps trimmed. What's another? There are moments that come into our lives that require of us courage, character, and fierce love. There are moments in which we're summoned to decision and to action. There are moments when we realize what's at stake. We decide if we're prepared, if our lamps are trimmed and burning, so to speak, trimmed and burning the oil of love and faith. If we're not prepared, we respond out of fear. Lawrence Lamer has written a new book called The Lynching, the epic courtroom battle that brought down the Klan. And it's how Morris Dees of the Southern Poverty Law Center took the United Klans of America to civil court for a murder and a lynching of a man in Alabama in 1981. And Dees showed that the United Klans of America, even as it didn't commit the actual murder, nevertheless ordered it done, expected it to be done. And it was the first time a hate group was found culpable for the actions of individuals that it inspired. And so that was the trial that ultimately brought the Klan down. And in researching this book, Lawrence Lamer discovered a bunch of new things about Alabama Governor George Wallace. Wallace really created an atmosphere of hate that ultimately contributed to this lynching because he cynically used integration for his own purposes. In fact, later in life, Wallace said that he thought he was going to be going to hell. because of his actions. He knew that integration was going to happen. And yet, at his first inaugural address in 1963, he said these famous lines to great applause: segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. He used this fear and hate of the voting bloc to further his own career, even as he knew that integration was inevitable. He could have made a different choice. At that moment of decision, he could have been one to shepherd the people of Alabama to accept integration. He could have been like de Klerk of South Africa and bring an end to a racist and unjust system. But because his lamp wasn't trimmed and ready, because it was not full of love and trust, he backpedaled into fear and hate because it would get him support from those who were filled with fear and hate. When I talked with Lawrence Lamer, he said there's something similar going on, perhaps with another presidential candidate. Doesn't believe any of that stuff. He's not going to put up any wall. He knows he's not going to ban Muslims. But he knows saying that nonsense gets some votes. My friend Ray Bagnuolo, of all that may freely serve LGBT rights group in the Presbyterian Church, said the church lost an opportunity at this General Assembly. It had the opportunity to speak truth and reconciliation for the harm that the church has done to the queer community over these past decades, from our wrong theological views and the violence and hate that has resulted and continues to result because of those views. We had the chance, Ray said, in the week that followed after the horrific slaughter in Orlando, in which a self-loathing person murdered gay people because they were gay. We had the chance, said Ray, for the church to take a clear stand and to start a national conversation about the hateful rhetoric against the queer community, rhetoric that comes from the church's damaging theology and faulty biblical interpretation. We could have said something, and it was on the table. But our lamps were not trimmed and burning. We didn't have the courage. We did not speak from truth or love. We did not recognize the moment. We acted instead out of fear. We were afraid of angering those who still affirm the rhetoric that calls the queer community sinners and sick. That rhetoric creates an atmosphere of violence. We had the chance to name it and begin healing. We missed the moment. We missed the arrival of the bridegroom. A few weeks ago, I preached on the second parable, the parable of the talents, in my sermon about the whistleblower. The hero, despite what we've been told during stewardship time, is the third guy. He buries the talent, and he calls out the master for injustice. Whistleblowers pay a price, and they are also the ones who can save us from ourselves. These are the ones who show up and who speak an uncomfortable truth to the powers that be on behalf of those who suffer. The two other successful slaves in this parable make their money, although the parable doesn't say it explicitly, but those who heard it would know. They make their money by increasing debts and foreclosing on the peasants whose families had been farming their piece of land for generations. The whistleblower said, "I'm not playing. I'm not contributing any further to this injustice. You reap where you do not sow," the whistleblower said to the master. "I buried your dirty money. Take it back." That's where the church needs to show up today. We need to blow the whistle on unjust and unsustainable practices. We need, at the very least, not to profit ourselves from them. Now, we live in a complex economic system, and it's difficult to navigate all the geopolitical realities, but we can't let that be an excuse for inaction. Do the products we buy and the investments we make as individuals and as a church contribute to human flourishing, now and in the future? Do they contribute to peace now and well into the future, seven generations hence? People of good faith may disagree on exactly how that plays out, but we must be willing to agree on that principle and to show up and to have that discussion. The parable summons us to be critical of the very institutions that sustain us. And it's not easy. It's hard. It requires risk. And it requires courage to look at the larger pictures. Now, I'm not oblivious that this is the 4th of July weekend. I like to think of myself as a patriot, but I'm not a nationalist. 55 years ago, former military general President Dwight Eisenhower warned us of the armaments industry. In the councils of government, he said, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. End quote. His prophecy has become true 100-fold. We manufacture so many weapons, we sell to all sides. Then we have the enemies use our own weapons against us. And if there aren't enough enemies of our enemies to whom we can sell weapons, we sell them to our police departments. And if there are not enough police to buy all we can manufacture, we sell them on the street, even to those connected with terrorizing our own people. Every time there's a mass shooting, and that happened right after Orlando, every time there's a mass shooting, we don't tighten gun restrictions. The opposite happens. Gun sales increase. We have military bases all over the planet, and whenever people ask if this is right, the response is, well, we need jobs, or we need to be secure, or we're not patriotic. The church needs to show up. Blow the whistle. The final story in Matthew 25 is the parable of the judgment. Now, I like Matthew's gospel, but I don't like all of it. And Matthew has unfortunately given us the legacy of a punitive God who sends people to hell where there is weeping and gnashing of teeth. He does that too many times, and once is too many. It's a punitive, violent God. I don't know if it reflects the author's need for revenge, but the author wants to speak about the urgency of living with justice and peace, of turning the other cheek, of loving the enemy. And the God that Matthew describes doesn't do any of that. The God is less moral than the humans. It's a puzzling thing. I mean, the ethics of Matthew's gospel are majestic. The Sermon on the Mount, the final parable of showing up with the poor, the naked, the hungry, the thirsty, the imprisoned, the stranger, and the sick. Yeah, it's what it's all about. It's the charter for following Jesus. And the irony of this story is that at one hand, I guess you could say it's about who makes it to heaven or hell, the sheep or the goats, yet neither of them knows what they were supposed to do in the first place. They're all surprised. The righteous surprised that they did what they did and didn't know there was a reward coming. And those who were unrighteous didn't know any better either. I wonder if Matthew is just kind of winking at us as he's writing this parable of Jesus, spoofing the whole judgment thing. In any case, this passage is most certainly a charter for where the church is called to show up. In liberation theology, this passage has inspired the phrase, a preferential option for the poor. This Jesus thing is about showing up like the Messiah did in Henry Nouwen's parable at the city gate, among the wounded as wounded, unbinding and binding one wound at a time so as always to be ready. If we ever have a question when we meet in deliberation about who we are or who we should be or what we should do, where we should show up, Matthew 25 is a charter. I'm going to end with the words of Rick Ufford Chase from his book, Faithful Resistance. He writes, Christians, if we are to have any currency in the multi-religious landscape of the United States, must be clear that we will not back down from the gospel values of the 25th chapter of Matthew. Like the five bridesmaids who tended their lamps, we are ready to step into the unknown. Like the third slave who refused to take advantage of his sisters and brothers for his own or his master's gain, we withdraw our consent from the dominant culture. Like the sheep gathered at the right hand of the Son of Man, we stand with the poor, the dispossessed, the sick, the foreigner, and the incarcerated. Amen.